you start today. Mic on. Good morning. Are we on here? I'll assume so. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is the regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission on a special day this month. So if the clerk will please call the roll.
Commissioner Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Mouskow?
Here.
Commissioner White?
Here.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Here.
Please let the record indicate Commissioner O'Grady is absent.
And we don't have anyone to sing a patriotic song for us this morning. Would anyone like to sing? Mr. Stevenson, do I see you volunteering?
I sing in groups of 50 or more.
Oh, anyone else like to volunteer? Mr. Marshall, did you want to volunteer this morning? Next time. Okay, we'll remember that. We'll remember that. So with that, we'll just move on to the flag salute, if everyone will please stand.
United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll move on to public comment period, and the room is not full today. That's an understatement. Anyone here hiding somewhere with some comments? So seeing none, we'll close public comments and move on to planning staff updates.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Warren Hove, Department of Planning and Building. I have two quick things, but like a broken record, I'll start with the summer schedule. As you noted, July, we're not meeting on our traditional second and fourth Thursdays. We're instead meeting on the first and the fifth Thursdays. So your next meeting will be July 29th, and at the end of the meeting, the chair should adjourn the meeting to that date. Then in August, there's only one meeting. It's on the fourth Thursday, August 26th. And then in September, we're back to the regular second and fourth Thursdays. Then the other thing I wanted to mention, because this has been an item of interest to your commission and to the general public, is that the board will be having a continued discussion of policy choices for the temporary events ordinance. And we had originally scheduled it for July 13th, but that has been rescheduled for August 10th. So if you can note that, and if the listening public can note that, we'll make sure there's no confusion. The board will take up temporary events again on August 10th. It's not a public hearing, formal public hearing on amendments. It's still further discussion. It's a report back that they asked for in January on certain policy issues. And that staff report should be available about a week before the meeting. So that's all I have for staff updates.
You back at it. Can I clarify with our chair that she will be, in fact, back on the 29th of July to chair instead of being gone? Yes, indeed. I had planned to be gone at the end of the month, but I will be here after all.
We'll note that on the docket because for several months we've shown you being out that day, but you had told me that your plans may change.
Plans have changed, yes.
Are there any other commissioner absences in the next month or two that we should be aware of? If not, Commissioner O'Grady's gone today, but he's scheduled to be back for the rest of the summer meetings.
So we're all here. Sounds like we're all here.
Okay.
No travelers, big travelers. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Hope? Got the scheduling down? Looks like yes. So with that, we'll move on to our consent agenda. We have a couple of items on the consent agenda. And any other commissioners interested in pulling any of these items? Okay, so hearing nothing, I am interested in pulling A1 and also C. I just caught one change to the minutes. So I'm not seeing Ms. Fuse on A1. Is anybody here?
Yes, Nancy Orton.
Oh, Nancy, you're on this
item, as well as we have two, Mr. Marshall and Fred Andrews from Public Works, that can speak.
And I'll speak to this. Okay, and so I'm not seeing anyone here. One person is here. Anyone? I'll open public comments on any of these consent agenda items. Are you here to speak to an item? Are you here for item one?
Yes.
Okay.
We're just doing the consent agenda items now.
If you'd like to fill out a speaker slip, we'll have that ready. There are some in the back of the room and in the front on the podium here. So with seeing no one else to speak to the public comment on the consent agenda, I'm pulling A1 and C. So do I hear a motion then to accept item B1?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, moved and seconded. So all in favor of approval of item B1?
Aye.
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 Okay, so we've passed item B1 then. Let's go back to A1, the conformity report. And just the question I have, I'm not clear, maybe best directed to Mr. Marshall, or I'll look the other way to Ms. Orton. I'm just not clear on the route that pedestrians would have to take if this parcel is abandoned and this isn't a public throughway. I looked at the maps, and it sounds like there's a way still for pedestrians to get to commercial areas, but I'm not sure if that involves some extra distance or what.
Sure. Glenn Arsenal, County Public Works, Chair Wyatt. They would take Jessica. Basically, we're closing the extension of Rosanna, which goes from Jessica to the commercial center, and instead they would take Jessica to Division Street and then around into the commercial center, and there's sidewalk the entire route, so it is pedestrian friendly.
But so people coming from I don't have direction on this map, but so people coming from what's on the right side of my map on A, or say the top on A19,
okay,
and then who would now maybe be able to take Rosanna over to what I assume is commercial then on this left side, now have to come all the way down to Division?
They have to take Jessica to Division, exactly.
So that's an extra 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 houses or something.
Right. I can...
Yeah, if you could pull it
briefly
up...
Briefly, we're looking at about an additional 500 feet that they have to walk.
500 feet, so we're at about not a quarter of a mile... So we're at about a tenth of a mile extra distance. Okay. And do we have any sense of use of this currently? I did read the staff report that there's some sort of illicit use rather than actual useful use.
Yeah.
I'm
unaware of how well it's used or how often it's used, but it is definitely a shortcut. So if people wanted to use it, it would be nice. But and now they would have to go around. But given the safety concerns, it's well worth pursuing this closure, this abandonment.
Okay, but safety concerns, then again, just what we see in the staff report, that people are loitering on the parcel. Is there some other safety concern, or it's just this loitering issue, or is it a liability for the county in general? And I guess I see loitering a possibility on any trail or pathway,
sure.
And that's a constant claim and, you know, potential threat, perceived or real.
About 6 months ago, I think I heard rumor, and I can't verify this, but there was some drug use in that area as well. So it's kind of a shady little spot that's not conducive to family-friendly movement or pedestrian movement. I see Fred Andrews is stepping up, and he may have some better information than I do.
If I may, Fred Andrews, Public Works. When the development of the property, the Castagnino's property in front, there's a car wash, and part of that car wash, they also built massive sound walls that are just concrete block walls. So as you walk down this alleyway, which really has never been offered as a pedestrian easement, it's just been a remnant of an abandoned portion of an abandoned street in 1999, so what you have is a walkway going toward the commercial development, then you have a big block wall. So, I mean, it's pretty invisible, and a lot of activities happen. You know, a lot of the neighbors have complained over the years, the property owner that did get the half of the abandoned street. You know, there's drug dealing that's going on down there. People hang out. There's a lot of tagging. There's a lot of graffiti that's there. And it just was never properly developed as a public pedestrian-friendly access.
Okay.
And really, there is paved streets. There are improved sidewalks all the way around. Yes, it does prohibit a shortcut going to this commercial development, but it's it just is not planned well, and unless there was a whole new, you know, development or a whole new alignment, it just is, to the best of our interest, we think, to close it up. We still have our drainage easement there, the drainage basin, and this is just a small, uneconomic remnant that we just have determined is probably best to just offer to the adjacent owner for plottage.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Andrews. Understanding that meets up to a high retaining wall, kind of blocking access or visibility, helps me understand this better. Because otherwise, you know, I'm a fan of having cut-throughs as a pedestrian and cyclist. Few extra, you know, a little extra distance matters when you're trying to walk around.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm concerned about any potential loss of, you know, availability to get through most directly from one thing place to another.
Currently, if you walk down Rosanna Place and you look through, you cannot see into the commercial development, you know, which would normally be what you'd be looking for, to be able to walk straight through into the commercial development. You see a wall, and then you see a turn, and it's just, it's not pedestrian friendly, or is it really safe at this point in time?
Okay, understood then. So I think I'm comfortable then agreeing with these findings that it's in conformity.
I have one question, Madam Chair. On the abandonment of Rosanna Place, it looks like the curbs are in, and it's a stub street, Glenn. Is that correct? At least on the map that I'm looking at, on A19.
Oh, the A19. I think it's just showing the right-of-way. No, there is no curb and gutter.
Okay.
Is there a paved path, right?
It's not paved, it's like
the decomposed granite path.
So the corner curbs shown on this subdivision map aren't in place. The street runs, the curb runs through like it doesn't have that stub.
There is no physical street there. I'm looking at the aerial photography, and it's
blocked by curb there. So that, I can't see it on my aerial with the black square around there, but the sidewalk is continuous through that area then?
That is correct. It's
okay.
Continuous and cuts off of that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and since this is just a conformity report, we are making some general, I guess just these general findings are required to be met?
Actually, your commission is being asked to do today is to receive and file the report. The staff has made a determination that it is in conformance with the general plan. We've noted some policies where it's not in conformance with, others that it is. But our overall conclusion is, because of the public safety issue, it is in conformity. Now, your commission today is just receiving and filing. If someone files an appeal of this decision, then there will be a hearing scheduled before your commission, and then you will have the ability to make your own judgment on those findings.
Okay. I just find it relative information, kind of on that safety, that wall is there and there isn't visual access, but I guess that's incorporated here into the record that Mr. Anders has brought to our attention. So do I hear a motion then to receive and file this?
So moved.
Okay, seconded. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, so moved. Moving on then to C, item C, we have minutes from May 27. And apologies, Madam Clerk, I just found one correction. And I think Mr. O'Grady will be glad that we make this correction to page C6, middle of the page. Dan O'Grady, it currently reads, cannot support a finding of incompatibility with the neighborhood. I think Mr. O'Grady would want us to make that read, cannot support a finding of compatibility with the neighborhood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So noted.
Okay. So with that change, do I hear a move to approve the minutes of whatever date that is, 27 May?
So moved.
Second, as amended.
Okay. And all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you. That gets us through the consent agenda items. And with that, we will move on to our regular agenda, item 1. And while staff is coming forward, I will note that item 1 is our only item, so we may have a very short meeting today. And welcome Ms. Terrell, Mr. Lilly, Mr. Oliveira. Mr. Stevenson is also stepping up to the plate on this one. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairperson Wyatt and members of the Commission. Morgan Terrell, planning staff.
Madam Chair, would you like me to introduce the item?
Oh, I think that is the usual routine. So, yes, thank you, I would.
Continued hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend Titles 22 and 23 of the County Code. County File Number LRP 2009-00002, Supervisorial Districts, all Chuck Stevenson and Morgan Terrell, Project Manager, Chuck Stevenson introducing.
Thank you, Ramona. Chuck Stevenson, Planning Staff. I'll just turn it over to Morgan Terrell.
But first, with the Chair's permission, Dana Lilly with your Planning Staff, I just want to make a sort of related, it's not part of the hearing item, just an announcement. And I left a flyer on the dais for each of the commissioners that on Saturday, July 17th, there will be a fundraiser for the Maxine Lewis Homeless Shelter at 2555 Ocean View in Los Osos. And we have posted this in the courthouse, and there's some flyers outside of the board chambers. Thank you.
Mr. Lilly, would you like to just put that on screen for a moment so anyone watching could see that address and contact information on the screen? Since it's a relevant item here to today's agenda item. So looks like that shows up on screen. And so for more information or to donate, I see two phone numbers, 528-7638 and 534-9182. We'll hope that's a big success.
All right, good morning. Morgan Terrell, Planning Staff. On June 24th, Planning Staff presented proposed ordinance amendments to Title 22, Title 23, and the Land Use Element Local Coastal Plan, Part 1, Coastal Zone Framework for Planning to address emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing. At that hearing, your Planning Commission continued the item and asked staff to come back with other options for addressing emergency shelters. So I will briefly go through the options that were addressed in the memo. There's 8 different options that I've addressed. The first one is, and all of these will only speak to emergency shelters. The first one is the proposal right now is to allow emergency shelters in 3 land use categories, ministerially under certain circumstances. Another option would be to permit emergency shelters ministerially only in 1 or 2 land use categories, and then possibly allow discretionary permits in other land use categories. And the general impact of that would be increased processing fees and time for applicants and possible neighborhood opposition preventing approval of shelters. Another option would be to create a new land use category or an overlay combining designation. This is a general plan amendment, so this would result in significant processing time. It would require more environmental analysis, likely public opposition, and the county could not meet its statutory deadline of August 24th. It could also lead to residents believing that shelters would be constructed in the specific land use categories or overlay zone. The third option would be to choose specific sites countywide rather than just land use categories. So this would be site-specific, obviously, and so more environmental review would be needed to look at these specific sites. The county also could not meet the August 24th deadline if this option was chosen, and additionally, neighbors would obviously be led to believe that specific sites would be developed rather than leaving it open to different land use categories. The next option, this kind of speaks now to different development standards that you have discretion over to change based on our proposal. The first one is you could allow fewer or more persons in emergency shelters. Right now, the proposal is a maximum of 100 persons. The one of the impacts of that would be some shelters may not be able to efficiently run facilities with fewer than 100. It's possible, according to Community Action Partnership, that you could, but after speaking with them and doing research in other jurisdictions, 100 seemed to be like the number that was feasible for nonprofits. Another option would be to decrease or increase the required square footage for on-site waiting and intake areas, so where clients come in and check in and wait if they need to. And decreasing the size could lead to these clients possibly waiting in public spaces outside, and I know that's not preferable generally. Increasing the size is possible, but that could use up valuable space for client beds, and it may or may not be needed. It depends on how the structure is actually laid out and how the facility is run. So right now our proposal is 7% of the total square footage. The next option would be to require fewer or more supervisors or managers. And so right now it's limited to, go to that.
I think you had one per 50 and two.
Yeah, and a minimum of two on-site managers plus additional staff and volunteers up to the discretion of the nonprofit for 51 to 100 beds. You could require more or less, but the problem with requiring more, and I think Community Action Partnership is here and they're going to speak to that, is that it's expensive to have actual managers and supervisors, whereas there's qualified staff that could also kind of run the facility, and it might not be required 24 hours a day to have management there. And fewer is an option, too, because from what I understand, shelter can run the staff like I just spoke about. However, it wouldn't guarantee that a management person is on staff all the time. And then other options under management, you could require a neighborhood relations plan or a management plan, something similar to that, where basically the surrounding community could call up the shelter, have a 24-hour contact, and have regular meetings with the nonprofit provider. So that's an option too.
Is that not already conditioned?
It isn't to have a management plan or a neighborhood relations plan. Right now it's only strictly the 1 to 2 supervisors or managers required.
Okay.
But you could require something like this, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And then the seventh one is security. Right now there's limited security required, 2 security cameras for any shelter, and then a security guard for 50, if there's 50 or more clients. You could require more security, or you could require less security. You could require just during peak hours, for example. That's been one suggestion from Community Action Partnership. Or you could just rely on security cameras. You don't even have, so that's possible to change that too. And then the last one is under proximity to other emergency shelters. Right now, our text reads that no emergency shelter shall be within a 300-foot radius from another emergency shelter. And the law states that you can't require it to be more than 300 feet. So for clarification, staff was suggesting possibly to say no closer than rather than within, just to make sure we're clearly within the law. But you also could allow shelters to be closer than 300 feet. For example, if you think that 200 feet is fine, then you could also just say no shelter shall be closer than 200 feet.
Could I ask a question at this point on that distance?
Sure.
Morgan, by saying no closer than 300 feet, wouldn't we be in noncompliance because we would be outside the 300 foot?
If we said closer than, it'd be basically up to 299 feet instead of 300.
That's what my question was. Should we change that number to 299 or 200? Or?
Well, if we said closer than instead of within, staff felt that we would meet that.
if I can add to that, Dana Lilly, it's our understanding the intent of that provision in state law is so that jurisdictions wouldn't require that there's only one in a community or that it be a mile or 500 feet. 300 seems to be the number, so we went right to the maximum. We were pretty confident it was okay as is, but the recommended language should clarify it.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but my understanding is if you have two shelters, the law is requiring that you cannot require that they be more than 300 feet apart. So you can require they be up to 300 feet apart, but no more than that. So if we say that they cannot be within a 300-foot radius, aren't we pushing them just beyond that 300-foot mark?
That's why we're suggesting the new language. We think that will comply.
Okay. It's a little confusing to me.
It is.
That foot difference there in the wording.
I just thought if we change it to 250 or 200, or maybe that's something
we discussed.
Well, we
could discuss. That's what staff is suggesting.
Because if we're limiting zones, then it may be beneficial where they could be closer to.
Oh, good. Let's come back to that soon. That's on the list. Yeah.
And then I just wanted to provide a few statistics for you, too, based on the homeless enumeration. We didn't provide this last time, but just some countywide information on homeless. We have 3,829 homeless countywide. About 35% of those are children and teens. 56% have lived here in the county for 5 or more years, so they're generally not transient in nature. 38% are originally from Slo County, and 54% were experiencing homeless the first time. This was in 2009. The average age is 44. About 18% were working at the time, and the most common reason for becoming homeless was just unable to pay rent. So whether that's not having a job, or some of them are victims of the economy. About a quarter of them had substance abuse problems, and 41% went to the ER in the last year. That's just kind of a quick snapshot. And staff still has the same recommendation as the previous hearing, which is that your Planning Commission recommend to the Board adoption of the proposed amendments to Title 22, Title 23, and the Land Use Element Local Coastal Plan, Part 1, Coastal Zone Work for Planning, Framework for Planning, and adoption of the Negative Declaration ED09-193. This concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Thrill. One more question. Transitional housing has come up, so there's no additional information than you have in the staff report as to transitional housing.
There's no additional information, and the reason for that is that the law states that transitional housing and supportive housing have to be treated the same way as residential uses within the same zone. And that's interpreted to be basically that they have to be treated the same way as any other single-family or multifamily development within our land use categories. So staff didn't feel like we really had discretion to provide you options for those uses.
Okay, thank you for that elaboration.
Hopefully we can get into discussion of that a little later.
Sure. So are there specific questions for staff on any items in the staff report or not in the staff report at this point before we open public comment?
I would just like to follow up on the last question you just asked about the transitional housing. In the, it's not labeled in our new staff report, but it's page 5 of the Senate Bill 2, I believe it is. It's in the first paragraph under 6. It says, transitional housing and supportive housing shall be considered a residential use of property and shall be subject only to those restrictions that apply to other residential dwellings of the same type in the same zone. That appears to me that it doesn't say that we have to list it in our table two, that if it does, it can come with the same restrictions that other listings in table two have. And my concern was the numerical quantities of people in these. So you can explain that to us, how you can't accept that interpretation or why.
Yeah, so if some jurisdictions are, when they're addressing the state law, are not explicitly saying or defining transitional and supportive housing. However, they still have to treat them the same as single-family or multifamily dwellings within the same use and the same zone. So basically, I understand that some jurisdictions just at this time may not address it. However, they still have to comply with the law, and they're aware of that. And staff felt that it's most clear for both the public and for staff that are implementing this to have definitions and explain how they're allowed, so it's very clear when you come to the front counter and you can see what where this fits in basically into our ordinance and what's allowed. And additionally, one other point is that in our housing element under program 3.A, which addresses this, the state actually required us to put in language that we would address transitional and supportive housing in our ordinances in order to comply, or basically to get our housing element certified to make sure that we're going to implement this. So that is part of that program too.
Well, when it comes back to us, maybe staff can walk us through some of these potentials and the A1 and the A2.
Okay.
Through the land use zone.
So noted, then we'll get into this more after we hear from the public. Are there other specific questions then on the staff report? Okay, so with that, I'll open up public comment. I have one speaker slip, Dee Torres. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. My name is Dee Torres, and I am the Homeless Services Director for the Community Action Partnership. Part of my role as that job is to oversee the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter, the Prado Day Center, and our case management program, which is countywide. I'm here to answer any questions that you might have, but in particular to speak a little bit on the management and the security requirements that you're looking at. It's my hopes that we are able to limit the requirement in regards to the actual management and the security. I'm hoping that in regards to management, to let you know that we do have a management team that's on call 24 hours to work with trained staff. In regards to the security element, I'm hoping that if we do require actual security guards on site in addition to the cameras that we're looking at and the trained staff, that we'll be able to limit that to peak hours. Of course, as you can probably guess, the reasons for my comments are surrounding funding. As you probably are well aware, it's an ongoing battle, sustainability, and running these shelters. So when we're putting our management team together and our staffing patterns together, we always have to take that into consideration. So I'm here to answer any questions that you might have, but just to kind of relay that. So thank you.
Ms. Torres, while you're up, just a few questions then in that regard.
Sure.
Regarding security currently at both Prado and Maxine Lewis, do you have any security guards there now?
No, we tried a security guard, I guess, in the early days of the shelter. It was a little bit before my time. I've been with Homeless Services for about 12, 13 years, and it's before my time. I've heard it's kind of a legacy in the agency. It was a long time ago, but that it was problematic.
Having the
security there, it was problematic. It kind of instigated things more than it relieved things. It was stressful on the clients, and it really wasn't comparable to having trained staff that are used to and very trained in dealing with that particular segment of the population. So we have found since I've been there over the last 13 years or so, that having the trained staff working really closely with the SLO PD and county mental health for crisis calls and things like that have been enabled us to keep the sites, knock on wood, safe and secure.
Okay, and what about security cameras? Do you have some on-site cameras at all now?
None, either at the day center or at the shelter. We are very open to, and it actually is in our current proposed budget for the service center that we're looking at on South Higuera, to include security cameras, because we do feel that it's a larger facility and that will really aid the staff to keep it safer.
So you're looking at that for the
proposed site.
But haven't used it at any of the existing. And how long have Maxine Lewis and Prado been in operation?
Prado Day Center is hitting on 13 years right now. And the Maxine Lewis Shelter, I think Dana was there from the beginning, but I want to say 20, but it's, yeah, better
20
than 20 years. A little bit before my time, but.
Okay, and 50 beds for 20 years?
50 beds, at the Maxine Lewis Shelter, and then we have the overflow program of another 30 that we oversee in conjunction with the Interfaith Coalition for the Homeless. So with volunteers, we move people back and forth. So we oversee nightly on two locations up to 80 to 90 clients.
Right now.
We don't use security cameras.
And so my other clarification question then in regards to some of the sort of eight items we're discussing here are with staffing.
Mm-hmm.
And so will you help us understand then the distinction in staffing between management, we're talking about some conditional language for managers versus staff versus volunteer. Will you just help us understand how that currently works and how we might find some realistic kind of conditional wording for that?
Currently, both at the Day Center and the Maxine Lewis Shelter, we have one manager that manages the seven-day-a-week operation of each one, so two, one for each site. And they work closely with, they have a part-time kind of shelter supervisor that is in charge when the 2 days a week that the manager does not cover shifts or not on site, actually. And then they have two line staff that work in conjunction with that supervisor or that manager, depending on what day of the week it is. So we have three staff on site at all times on both sites. We supplement that with volunteer support especially during peak hours. Our goal daily is to have at least one to two volunteers that work with staff at all times. We're not always able to meet that goal, but we are generally able to meet that goal by at least using volunteers during the peak periods. And we find the peak periods in the evening are usually around the dinner hour from about 5 till about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And at the Day Center, the peak period is in the morning when we open up breakfast till about at the end of lunch, so about 8 to 1 is a peak period. So we work real hard to make sure that we are fully staffed during those peak periods, supplementing our three site staff with a volunteer. At least one volunteer.
Okay, so I'm hearing 8 to 1's peak period at Prado, and will you repeat again what peak period is at Maxine?
5 to 10 is a peak period before people usually go down to sleep.
Okay, thank you. Those are my specific questions at this point. Do other commissioners have specific questions at this point? Okay.
Yes, my light's on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, you.
Ms. Torres, first of all, thank you for your good work.
Thank you.
I know it's appreciated by all the community. As far as the security and the management, I assume that you would do what was necessary, whether it were conditioned or not. You would, if you thought you needed security, you'd bring in security.
Yes.
And your experience is there's not a lot of problems that
police
have to be called on a regular basis.
Correct.
Okay. What we're being asked to do here today, as I'm sure you're probably aware, is to create some zones or a zone where these can go without much public participation or community involvement in that decision. And from your experience, I would assume that it's very important and critical that you get public and community buy-in for these shelters to be successful. So I would just like to get your thoughts on allowing these to go essentially without a lot of public or community participation. I'm having a real hard time. I think you were here at the last hearing, and that's my concern. I think that we're all trying to do a good thing here and the right thing, but I'm concerned with our zest to accommodate the needy here and the homeless that we may create some unintended consequences and some backlash from the public. Mm. And I just would like to, if you could share your thoughts on that with me, I'd appreciate it.
Wow, that's a big question. I guess from my experience and in my current experience helping to bring the South Higera site into fruition, it is taking a lot of work with the neighborhood. I don't think that a shelter stands a chance. I mean, fundraising is such a huge part of any nonprofit, especially with emergency shelters. I don't think a shelter could even begin to think of coming to fruition unless there was community involvement or having any chance of sustainability. So I think that's a part of the whole plan. I'm not real concerned that shelters would be able to just kind of spring up in communities where they weren't welcome and have any chance of sustainability. So it's not something that I've really...
You know, you brought up a good point, and I think that's an excellent answer to my question, because it enlightened me to a thought that I hadn't had previously, that even if they were permitted without a lot of public input, it may be a
They wouldn't stand a chance without some without community support. It's a self-regulating and daily. I'll tell you, it's a daily partnership with the community. Prado Day Center, as an example, because I before I was the director, I was the on-site manager of the day center for about a decade. So, I as the manager and direct person that was responsible to keep this place going, given the economic shortfalls that we went into every single year. Community relations is number one, and we wouldn't be open, and we wouldn't have been able to last as long as we have if we didn't have the support of the community. We do fundraising. We have to fundraise about 50% of our overall budget every single year, and that comes straight from the community.
Well, those are some excellent points, and it gives me some comfort, so thank you very much for that.
I'm
sure you don't need me to point out to you that the irony of when these are most in need is when it's the most difficult economic time.
Definitely.
So I appreciate, again, your efforts, and we all need to try to step up. And,
great.
And when it's difficult,
thank
try
you.
To do the right thing.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're doing, too.
So, Ms. Torres, if there are no more specific questions at this point, if you will stay in front, stay with us. We may well have more
definitely.
As we work through
yeah.
these items.
Thank you.
Thank you. So anyone else here for public comment on this item? Okay, seeing no one, I'll close public comment and bring it back to the commission. And so I have a proposal for how we go about handling this item here. And what I've heard is a request from Commissioner White that we sort of separate out the two issues, that we separate out, first of all, let's handle emergency shelters, and then let's separately talk about the changes then for transitional housing, changes or non-changes, depending on how your slant goes on that. So let's start with emergency shelters. What we have before us is the supplemental staff report with 8 items for potential changes that were suggested or discussed and brought up at the last meeting. So I would make a proposal that we immediately do away with a couple of the numbers. discussions I don't think are necessary to have. That would be on item 2, the overlay zone. Maybe I'm jumping to assumptions here or quick conclusions, but I don't think that's something we want to waste time discussing. So is there anyone here who wants to discuss a new overlay, item 2 on the staff report? To take time on that? Tell me if I'm jumping too fast here or going in some kind of manner that's not working for commissioners. But I would say we take some time discussing the zones, number one, and we immediately skip discussion of the overlay. Am I hearing any support for a discussion of overlay? Hearing none, let's say we're not going to do that. I would also recommend then we skip discussion on item 3, specific site zoning. I don't think that's feasible. I think staff has clearly explained why not. Anyone wanting to discuss
that? I would like to discuss that a little bit, if you would indulge me
okay.
here. My thought was that may not be something we can do immediately. We may have to take the immediate action, but if that's something that could be pursued in the future, that was a question I had.
Okay, well,
if we could do it
we'll go back
current.
To it in order then. So we will discuss that then if you'd like to. I think item number 4, maximum number of residents, may merit some discussion. Or we're at 100 maximum now, and I'm comfortable with that. Are there commissioners who would like to discuss increasing or decreasing that number?
My only question would be how we derived at that number, if that's sufficient, if it's a large enough number, or if it's...
Okay, so let's go back to that then, if there are some questions on it.
Commissioner Chair Wyatt, maybe you should just be talking to Commissioner White, because last week both Commissioner Melskow and I indicated we were fine with the proposal as it was presented. So I don't really want to discuss any of this.
Yeah.
Okay. I gotta just make a motion to vote. You're being very, very conscientious here, but you know, why don't you just talk to Commissioner White about what he wants to discuss.
Well,
let's discuss it and then let's move on.
Well, 2 points on that.
You know,
first
so
of all, Commissioner White wasn't here at the last hearing.
I don't know, I'm explaining it.
Second of all,
I'm just trying to just say she's really being very conscientious, but that's where I am still, and so let's get going.
But if you recall, I'd ask for your patience and your indulgence here, because if you recall, I was ready to move it on last hearing. I'm not the one that wanted to be here today. But since
well,
we are...
the one who was isn't here, so
since
if I'd known that, I would have
So since we are, I would like to have you indulge me a little bit here. Let's methodically walk through this. Okay. I think it's way too important of an issue and can have way too many impacts on the public to just rush it on through.
So. I'm not saying we should rush it on through. I'm saying that you are the one that wanted to discuss it. So instead of asking all of us, you keep looking over at me, and I
okay.
talk to
you. So noted, I shall look to my left.
Thank you.
And not look to my right one at all. So we have a discussion on item 1, item 3, 4. I would say we also nixed discussion on item 5, changing the square footage for the intake area. I think staff very thoroughly researched that, so we're okay with taking that off the table, leaving that at the 7% minimum that staff has in there. Let's discuss the supervision and security, because I also think those are important and we may want to make some changes there. And I would suggest then that maybe we want to discuss the wording for number 8, too, because it sounds like Commissioner White may be comfortable moving that number down a little, which is fine by me. So I guess since this is maybe a conversation between mostly two of us here, I would just like to note that as from my perspective, having missed the last meeting, I did watch most of the video online, that I would like to make possibly a few changes that make this easier. Contrary to your kind of view that maybe we need to meet state law or do the minimum, are some people's, as far as I'm concerned, you know, at this time where we have great need and, you know, homelessness is a problem and maybe increasing, and we're all just but, you know, one step away from needing some of this help ourselves. I think, you know, beyond just doing the minimum to meet state law, which is our primary task here, I think maybe there are a few changes we can make to actually make it a little easier and support the efforts such as Community Action Partnership to make these things realities as we need them. So with that little bit there to start us going, let's start in, Commissioner White, and first of all, start with item 1, the zones.
Well, what I would be able to support is ministerial in one zone and a conditional use permit in other zones that staff's supporting. And the reason I'm landing there, and Ms. Torres's comments gave me a lot of comfort, as I've already said, because is mainly because of the democratic process and allowing public participation. Last Saturday in the Tribune, a Mr. Bravo wrote an article complaining about lack of public participation in the South Argyra Street project. And I felt compelled to bring that article and respond to it here today. And then yesterday I saw Supervisor Hill's response in the Tribune, and he was compelled to respond to Mr. Bravo also. And his response was articulating how important that public participation is, and that there was public participation on the South Argyra project. So I just feel for due process and the public having a right to be involved, that we need to involve the public as much as possible. Now, the state is mandating that we have zones where it essentially goes unchecked without public participation. I like staff's proposal to put it into where hotels, motels, that type of zone, ministerial, and then any others would be a conditional use permit. I wouldn't support a motion other than that.
Okay, as opposed to a hotel, motel zone, so are you talking about just CS zone, or which zone are you proposing?
It's the CS, I believe, is what staff proposed, and I'd ask staff before the hearing if they could walk us through some of these tables and zones so we have a real understanding of what where these locations may be and what these impacts might be. And that's the reason I was, to skip forward a little bit, that's the reason I was receptive to less than the 300 feet, because if we're in that particular zone. So a lot of the questions you asked me earlier about if I wanted to discuss different options would depend on where we're going with the zone
with
or
the
zones.
Okay, so there we are at the zones. You're suggesting one that we limit this and only allow for ministerial permit and CS. The current staff recommendation is that we allow for ministerial permitting in CS, PF, public facilities, and industrial, so three zones. So I've heard support from the last meeting then that we leave that at the three-zone recommendation, and I believe that was inland and coastal was just the CS zone ministerial. Am I correct on that?
It's the same three land use categories, but it's all discretionary. in the coastal.
Oh, all discretionary and coastal. Well, okay, thank
and
you.
And I wanted to talk about that a little bit further also. I've thought about that quite a bit since the last hearing. And you know, part of the law that requires that the area where these are to be allowed ministerially are where the need is the most need. And I don't recall the table of where the population of the most homeless reside in our county.
San Luis Obispo City.
Well, yes, San Luis Obispo City, but in our jurisdiction, in the county jurisdiction, I didn't know if that's a conflict with having...
We don't really know. The enumeration that's completed, they don't, in the unincorporated areas, they don't really say, like, by community where each person was located. We know generally just, like, regions, but that doesn't really tell you, for example... they were in Napomo versus Oceano or something like that. So it's a little bit difficult for staff to try to capture exactly where.
And if I recall, the explanation you gave to have this inequity in my mind with the coastal and the inland is because the Coastal Commission's influence and that they may not accept these going in without a public hearings. And part of me says we got that backwards. We should have the discretionary permits on the inland, and then then it would be ministerial on the coastal, and then the Coastal Commission could decide whether they want to violate state law because they're a state agency,
the county can't decide what the Coastal Commission.
I didn't say that they could. I said the Coastal Commission could decide.
No, but when the county's, maybe the staff wants to step in or the council, but when the county's making its law, it can't go around just saying, okay, well this is mandatory for the Coastal Commission. They can't make laws about what the Coastal Commission can or cannot do.
No, but we were given the example that the rationale for making this discretionary in the coastal is because of the Coastal Commission.
Well, that's a recognition that the county cannot require the Coastal Commission to do something. It's just a recognition of the way it works.
Yes, but
so we can't. Well, I'm just.
What I would suggest is that we for consistency that we keep it the same in the coastal and the inland.
We can't keep it the same. I mean, that's not what the state said.
The state is requiring at least one zone, one place where it's ministerially allowed. So if we make it discretionary inland and coastal...
It has to be discretionary on the coastal zone because the coastal commission will always have its discretion. So the county... law has to be discretionary in the coastal zone. So the question is, how many zones ministerially on the inland portion do we want to make?
Well, I'm not clear on that, but it has to be...
Madam Chair, I think Morgan might have something to clarify this a little bit more than what staff has said so far.
Yeah, our Assistant Director, Cami Griffin, was just reminding me that most of the permits that are ministerial in the inland areas are discretionary in the coastal areas because of the Coastal Act.
But just by the way the law works, they have to be discretionary for the coastal zone because it's the coastal zone, which means there's always going to be a higher authority. But on the inland zone, where the county itself is the highest authority, that's where we have where we're making a decision about. And I have to say that I am categorically in opposition to your opinion on this. I feel that the staff has done a wonderful job of really thinking about this, thinking about the intent of the law, thinking about the needs of the homeless, thinking about how very difficult it is to put up homeless shelters, as we're seeing in our city's fight about this. And they're saying all we're doing is removing one expensive, time-consuming part of what it would take to establish an emergency shelter. And as Ms. Torres so eloquently said, no organization would think to establish an emergency shelter without great public support and input and involvement. But to require then, on top of that effort, at the expense and time and just the detail work that's necessary to go through public hearings that are required by a CUP, seems to me adding kind of like just one huge extra burden to the whole process. And as Mr. Lilly said at the last meeting, the reality is, it's extremely unlikely that we're going to get anybody applying for an emergency shelter in county property because it's going to be places like San Luis Obispo City where the fights are. So I just feel like, you know...
So if that's the case, we wouldn't do any harm by requiring...
I feel it's important to really
Yeah, we could just talk about this whole thing as a theoretical exercise. I think it's important to really try to put our, quote, our money where our mouth is, put our laws where we really believe. And I think that talk about, you know, wanting public input on things like this, and forgive me, is basically talk about trying to be exclusionary NIMBYs. I mean, I've been involved in the homeless issues for many years as chair of the Health Commission, as on the Planning Commission of the city. I was sitting on the board of the Prado Day Center when I was on the Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, Dr. Brawley's comments exactly, and then Mr. Hill's comments in response to those are exactly the problem. Because no matter how much public input you get, there's always somebody who's going to say, oh, not an emergency shelter. We're talking about shelters for homeless
what?
Women and children. And I don't see why theoretically allowing an application for an emergency shelter, which is not going to happen anyway, to be in three zones automatically is such a big deal. So my theory is and I certainly respect your ability and I understand your reasoning, but I don't want to spend all morning talking about this stuff if you're just going to vote down a motion anyway. So let's just
I'm trying to vote for it. I want to.
You've already said you can't support a thing that has three zones, and so it's like, okay, I understand that, and if we'd had three votes for it last time, we would have just done it. So I don't want to spend a couple hours talking about all the details if Mr. White is not going to be able to support a motion.
No, I wouldn't be able to, because, again, I know it's an expensive cost to go through that, but at any price, to sell out the democratic process, I have a real hard time with that. And I understand there's overriding considerations that can be made and that are already being made by the state. That's why we're allowed to do this on a ministerial basis.
I really disagree with your categorization of selling out the democratic process. I think that Ms. Torres's comments tell you, and what I've observed is that these things require a great number of people being involved and a great deal of public support and involvement from business communities, from our faith communities, from our social services communities, and it's just inconceivable that you could consider a homeless or emergency shelter being established without public process. And so just because an official formal hearing through a CUP process isn't required does not mean there would not be great, great public involvement.
Well, there'd be several community meetings and so forth, and I do understand.
It'd be more than that. It would be years and years. I mean, I've watched what happened. I was very involved when the Prado Day Center was being established. It would be years of discussion between major stakeholders of all kinds. Neighbors, businesses, chambers, the faith community, the social services people, the medical community. There would be so much more discussion at that level than it would ever come forward at a public hearing. It just doesn't make sense. And yet, these public hearings, these CUP processes are very expensive. They require all kinds of reports. They require tons and tons of paperwork and legal stuff. What the state is saying is, you know what? Yeah, they're real impediments to actually getting homeless shelters put up. Let's make sure that counties have at least one place where they aren't required.
So with that, that's the question.
And I think
one place.
Well, Commissioner,
staff is recommending three places.
Well, Commissioner Christensen's making a very good argument. She's pulling me over because it tends to go to my fundamental beliefs anyway that it may not be a formal governmental process, but it's a community-involved, community-supported process. Or it's not, and again, like I said, Ms. Torres's comment struck me with an excellent point. And so I may be able to get through the emergency shelter zoning.
Okay,
let's think of that.
So what I would say is we not spend more time thinking about it. That's it. That's what we needed as Commissioner Christensen over here. To my right has very well and lengthily stated there is plenty of process. So, I see Commissioner Malska shaking his head too. We're not trying to eliminate public process and skirting around it, that there's plenty. So I'm hoping in the straw poll that we're going to have the unanimous agreement that we can recommend staff's proposal to allow the three inland zones.
Gene, are you comfortable with that? Do you see it that way?
Yeah.
So I do please if we can get unanimous support for that item one in a straw poll, then, as staff has proposed. Do I see a nod there, Commissioner White?
Yes, I'll go along with
that. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that start to the day. I think that's an important start to recognize that we're doing more than the minimum here.
Well, it's difficult for me because I don't want my position to be misinterpreted either way, because I do have strong beliefs about accommodating all of our population. And my concern is about is I think obviously is subverting the process and unintended consequences that can arise and putting the public's health and safety at risk.
Thank you, Commissioner White. So noted. And I also can't help but note the irony that sometimes as we rush through private projects, the process is called inefficient and slow and cumbersome. And some people criticize our slowness with private projects, and other people criticize our quickness with public ones. So it's a difficult task.
Hopefully you're not referring to me, because I hope the short time that I've been here, I've shown consistency that I like thorough public participation.
I'm not specifically referring to you. I'm referring to a general problem that difficulty facing us here.
Okay, thank you.
In the community. So with that, we've taken a unanimous poll to agree with the three zones as staff has recommended. So let's move on then to discuss the number three specific site item in the staff report. I would just immediately propose we don't want to look at specific sites, but Commissioner White, did you want to add something to that discussion? Or?
My question simply was if we can do both and concurrently, if that would bring any benefit to try to find a site, because I noticed you picked a much larger number to accommodate 675 rather than 100 that we're proposing here. And I didn't know if that could bring some benefit. It's something that the county may want to pursue.
I'll make an attempt to do that, Dana Lilly, your staff. The 675 homeless persons is kind of the county's share. So what staff has done is made sure that within the three zones, there would be ample sites to accommodate 675 homeless in shelters that could accommodate no more than 100 each. That's what we've done.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay. So we don't need to pursue both.
Okay, so seeing nods then that we're okay not discussing specific site option anymore. Let's move on to item four then, increasing or decreasing the maximum number of people allowed. Currently we have up to 100 people maximum in one shelter. Sounds like Ms. Torres, maybe you could come up. Are you comfortable with 100 person maximum, or if some higher number could make shelters more feasible? Do you have any comments on that?
This is something that Morgan and I discussed a lot, because as you probably know, we're planning to accommodate up to 200 people at our proposed site on South Higuera. So I was a little bit confused. It was explained that this is in the unincorporated areas, so that was a difference. And with the back and forth conversations that we had and the input from Morgan Terrell, I do feel comfortable with that, but I wouldn't want to go under that at all. I don't think it'd be feasible to actually run a shelter effectively, but I wouldn't be opposed to it increasing a little bit.
Okay, to give you a little more flexibility to open a shelter. I wouldn't want to go under 100, but I also understand there are constraints outside of the cities that we don't want to get too big. But I would also be open to increasing that number a bit if I see any interest from other commissioners.
My question was simply how we derived at the number, if for security reasons, if we feel that's the best manageable number, or...
It was from actually first speaking with D and Community Action Partnership and then doing research in other jurisdictions, and we are kind of seeing what other jurisdictions are doing around the entire state. There was kind of a range up to, 250 is what the city of San Luis is proposing, some are fewer. And then also the question of services really was why we initially limited it to 100. We figured that in the cities, since there are more services like medical and transportation, that we thought 100 would be appropriate after doing basically the three-prong approach, but I think it could be a little bit more.
Anyone in any interest in increasing that to 125 or 150 for a little added flexibility, or commissioners comfortable with the 100?
I'm comfortable with the 100 if that's staff's
recommendation. Okay, I, that seems a reasonable compromise then, seeing as the current facilities accommodate 80, and that's a good number, but maybe not too high a stressor then for outside of the cities. Okay, so let's leave that at 100 then as proposed. We're going to skip item 5 then. I think we've all agreed the intake area, we're comfortable with it, that 7% minimum requirement. Let's move on to item 6 and talk about supervision. So I'll start this off, I guess, and say I'm just in favor of allowing a little more flexibility on how we write the conditions for supervision. I think Ms. Torres has kind of explained how their system works, and I'm a little worried about requiring the manager-supervisor title, but maybe that's compatible with what they're doing as long as that's kind of on call. But I'm not sure we've written that clearly enough to allow flexibility. And I may be creating more of a problem than not.
So the state discusses management, and I had spoken with Dee about this because she was saying, you know, the title of manager could be an issue. So she suggested adding supervisor in there because some agencies may be a big difference, apparently, between a manager and a supervisor.
Okay.
So I don't know, she may want to clarify.
Yeah. Okay, and I guess I'm seeing the proposal with...
Can you give them clarify?
Yeah, and just the other issues, the title then, and it's not listed on-site or off-site. It sounds like now some management is on-call, which could serve the need without actually being on-site. So I'm not sure if we want to elaborate on that on or site or on-call. Ms. Torres, do you want to comment on that for us?
I would. It would be preferable to us if you could include the on-call management as part of that requirement.
Yeah, because it's so. Right now, as I understood it, you have a shelter supervisor on site, but often the manager is on call.
The manager's on call, and they do kind of trade that duty off. The supervisor could be on call as well when the manager's on vacation or something like that. I'm on call. There's always somebody on call. I'm as the director, I'm on call. I have a 24-hour hotline that they call me if there's emergencies. So we make sure that we are staffed that way, and it is due to financial, you know, restrictions and limitations. So make sure that we always have the facility adequately staffed, but somebody is also reachable if there's an emergency situation or something
so
like
it,
that.
It looks like our wording works with one manager / supervisor required for 50 beds and two for 51 for 100, but I'd be more comfortable if we added in on-site or on-call to that requirement.
Staff has a proposal to... Go ahead, Dina.
If it was the commission's pleasure to make that change on page 3 in today's packet, where it's item D, where it speaks to on-site management, the three places in that section that say on-site, if you added or on-call, then we believe that would make that change. I can read it if you like.
Yes, if you would please.
Let me get caught up, Dana. Where are we?
Just to clarify, this is actually an exhibit LRP 2009-0002A, page 3, and it's also in one other spot in Exhibit B, LRP 2009-0002B, page 2. It's the same language.
Thanks. Morgan is the thorough one.
Somebody has to be.
So item D, titled On-Site or On-Call Management, period, and then the sentence. Three sentences read, a minimum of one on-site or on-call manager or supervisor plus a different.
Okay with that, but that was from original research.
Next question, when it kicks up to over 50, do you see a need to increase it there or just or across the board, do the on-call, or maybe increase the on-site at the 50 number?
I would just suggest, as we've heard Ms. Torres say, the reality is that it's an absolute necessity for these shelters to function, that people be on site, someone knowledgeable, right, people be on site. So what I hate is just for it to be that the wording of our code requires somebody called supervisor or whatever our other word manager is, when there could be competent staff or volunteers who can handle things but don't have that title. So I'm worried about constraining the situation because of some title that we're requiring that may not be effective, and that's going to be relevant next when we segue into security. That could actually lead to a less effective coverage of the situation. So
that's my understanding, too, and also, speaking with D2, we are trying to foresee other nonprofits because they're not the only nonprofit in the county, and some of them run different ways, and their budgets are all different, so that's what we were kind of talking about. That and Dee was saying, we do have staff that are very qualified that we feel maybe we don't need a supervisor there sometimes, and that's where I think.
Well, in our area outside the cities, with the response times of police and fire and so forth, you don't see this being any kind of conflict or a different necessity than what Ms. Torres has experienced. You don't seem to have a need to call services or for help very often?
No. I mean, we have a really good relationship. We do call for services. It's not very often. When you have the competent staff, then that really is what makes the center run. Work real close with the clients. So, and actually having the supervisor title, like I said, as long as there is somebody that's on call that you can get to quickly, those decisions are handled usually right away, and it's imperative.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Stevenson, did you have a comment?
Thank you. Just to indulge you for a moment, picking up on Ms. Torres's comment about having competent staff, you may wish to include a word before the word staff as qualified or competent. Just it assures that the staff that are there receive some level of training.
And I'm not uncomfortable with that, but I'm also am a little because qualified and competent. It's the whole definitional.
Well, how about trained or would trained be
trained?
Trained.
Are we comfortable with that? That addition could be good.
That's not so subjective.
There's been some specific training. So what are commissioners comfortable with here? Enumerating some number of trained staff adding to the staff that we have in there already?
We just put behind, in front of staff, just put the word trained in several places where it's located.
So everywhere it says staff, put trained before.
Yeah.
Okay, so
it's not just a volunteer that walks in off the street.
Yeah, so if you're going to have an on-call supervisor, do you have trained staff
there?
That's there.
Okay, Ms. Torres, are you comfortable with that, adding in trained?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very much.
So do I see agreement then that we will add in on-site or on-call to all areas there for the manager supervisors, and we'll add in trained in front of the staff person requirement in that section? Okay, so we'll move on. That was our item 6 on supervision. Except there was another part of that then as to the neighborhood relations plan.
Yes,
and
thank
I
you.
Thought that was a good idea.
I think that's an excellent idea.
So I don't know how much elaboration we already have on that, but it does seem like something we would want. It would make sense to condition that be in place in some form. So does staff have a recommendation here on what form that be in, or just that it be, or?
If I could, basically, it would be a plan that would describe the contact arrangement. It would set up regular meetings with the immediate neighborhood to discuss concerns, and those meetings would occur on some regular basis. And that plan, that approach, would then be written up and provided to the director of planning and building for review and approval. So it wouldn't come back to you, it would just handle it at staff level.
Okay, and so am I seeing heads nodding interest in having this be a requirement?
Yes, I have that highlighted, so thank you for catching that.
Yes.
I was on the other page.
And other commissioners?
Yeah, that was a good additional option, I liked it.
Okay, and Commissioner Melchow, yes? Okay, so we're seeing an agreement then that we would want to add that into the conditions. And Ms. Torres, that you don't foresee that being any problem?
No.
Okay, so with that we would add in that condition. foreign neighborhood relation plan.
And I suggest adding that on to D, on-site management, just to make sure it's clearly within the legal framework of state law.
Okay.
Instead of adding an I at the end.
Okay. Do you want to read some wording for that there right now, or do you want to...
Yeah, we can make it as simple as saying something.
With that,
staff could clarify, that would be a sentence tacked right on the end of that paragraph D where we were talking about on-site management.
Correct.
Okay. With that, moving on to 7, security plan. So there's been some discussion of security at the facilities. And I would propose, having heard it particularly from Ms. Torres about the problems that security guards have caused, I would suggest that we revisit the security requirements. I'm not comfortable with requiring a guard and cameras, so I would hope we could take out or change some of those requirements.
Well, as I said in the last meeting, my instinctively I thought that security would be a high priority and a need. But after talking to staff and Commissioner Christensen, and I even referenced, I wish Ms. Torres would have stood up at that point, I came to a realization that it can be more of a hindrance than a solution.
Okay, good.
So, and Ms. Torres, again, gave me great comfort in the fact that if there's a need, it will be filled, irregardless of a condition or a requirement. So... and that just makes common sense. So
thank you, Commissioner
White. I'm
okay giving
that flexibility to.
So I would propose that we all recognize that security is, you know, of the utmost importance, and that if these things are going to succeed and continue to function, that the operator will handle that. So I would suggest we take out the requirement for a guard and cameras. I don't think either are necessarily helpful, and there could be more effective ways to provide better security.
Well, it sounds to me as though the cameras are actually kind of state of the art, kind of that's what they use. So yeah, I'm, and I think something about security should be in here. I think that makes sense in terms of just the public's expectations. If you're going to talk about the public's concerns, so I would like to just say leave the line about at least 2 security cameras are required with video recording capability and stop it there.
I agree, and I like the cameras just for documentation, if no other reason, and. You know, that's one reason I had having the neighborhood relations plan highlighted, because as a compromise to the security guards, I'm sure the neighbors and the facility can discuss security, and, you know, and neighbors could help with that, I'm sure.
Well, and so along those lines, I'm not sure why we need to require cameras, that there may be some more effective way to use that money. I don't know what the cost of security cameras is, but we've heard there aren't any at the existing facilities.
But we also heard they're being proposed at the next facility.
Right, yeah. I'm not proposing we.
Well, the cost of security
doesn't allow them to go in.
The cost of security cameras, I can tell you, are going to be way less than the cost of a security guard and pension plans and employee benefits and taxes. So,
but maybe the cost isn't that much more than some other part-time staff.
They're relatively inexpensive.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything that's not a person is way less expensive than a person. It doesn't matter whether they're making minimum wage or making a lot of money. Employees are expensive. They have to be trained. They have to be monitored. They have to be supervised. They have to be evaluated. They have to have regular this. They have to have, you know, yeah.
So it's just automate everything. Okay.
No,
okay,
I'm not saying that. Right. Don't get all. Don't get all the rage on me. I'm just saying that if you're going to talk about security, that is a really common, really... inexpensive, straightforward solution that works pretty well.
Okay, so right now we have written a proposal for something about cameras.
At least 2
see.
Security cameras are required with video recording capability.
Then is that over 50 or
that's just
for all of them?
Yeah,
all shelters.
For all shelters. Yeah. And nobody's going to go
I think they're a good idea. They can actually work to protect the shelter if it falls under accusations. It's a good tool for any review that needs to be done. So I think they're a necessity.
They're relatively inexpensive.
I mean, $2,500, you know, you can get
they
a good
they retape over themselves. There's a loop thing. It's
All right. I'm not seeing anyone.
You don't have one. You're
going along with me. No, my guests are there without me right now. I'm sure all kinds of nefarious activities are taking place. So I'm hearing no support for that. On 7, then, as far as security, I'm hearing then a consensus that we will not require a guard, but we would want to condition what minimum of 2 security cameras in specific locations. I don't know what that means, specific locations. So
the language right now that's in the exhibit would continue, I assume, unless we hear otherwise from your commission, but it reads right now at least 2 security cameras are required with video recording capability.
Okay, as read. Good. Okay, that's no specific locations, whatever that means. Okay, so I'm seeing nods that that meets everyone's approval. All right, I'll go along with that then. Moving on from security, then our last item.
So we could simply say no emergency shelter shall be closer than 300 feet. It's minor, but it's, or we could say it shall be less than 300 feet either way, just to clarify that we're not requiring more than 300 feet.
Okay, so got it. So I think we're in agreement with the intent there. Would the attorney of the bunch want to weigh in on the wording there, either of the attorneys up there? So it sounds like we're comfortable with this change to no closer than 300 feet to meet the intent.
Madam Chair, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I think it's fine the way it's written. If the commission would prefer to change it, you can, but I don't think it's necessary in order to comply with the statute.
So as written, do you mean, Mr. McNulty, no closer than or shall be within?
No emergency shelter shall be within a 300-foot radius from another emergency shelter.
You're okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay, I guess just for wording-wise, closer than. Oh, well, okay. No one seems to interested.
I'm going to trust County Council's interpretation.
So Council's okay with that?
You know,
that.
We've had these things in the past. We've had all kinds of interpretations of how you measure the 300 feet, whether you do it from the outside of the building or the door, whether it's a foot or not.
We've seen it.
You do it from the property line. You know, I think it's fine the way it's written. It's going to give us lots of opportunities to interpret it in a legal way.
These are all imaginary shelters anyway.
Okay, so hearing that from Council and no argument.
And that's not only one, but 2 actually show up.
Exactly.
So you'd have the option to measure them. What a miracle that would be.
Then we can debate whether that's property line or door to door.
They can bring it to us for interpretation.
Around the corner, straight through. Okay, so hearing no more discussion, let's just, sounds like we're comfortable, no shelter shall be within a 300-foot radius. Unless, did staff particularly want to change that, or no strong feelings?
No, it's...
No strong feelings.
Fine.
Then, we're okay on that one. So that was our last item then on emergency shelters. So it sounds like we do have a consensus on all items discussed. On our straw vote, then. So we can move along then from that to our discussion of transitional housing. So let's go there. Ms. Terrell, do you want to just start us off with a continuance of your previous introduction and explain staff's perspective on what we're doing or not doing here?
Yeah, so the way the law reads is that you have to treat transitional housing and supportive housing as a residential use and treat it the same way as other residential uses within the same zone. And since these are basically rented dwelling units, we treat them as single family and multifamily dwellings. And just for reference, it's in Exhibit A, it's on page 1 and 2, and then on Exhibit C. You'll see the same on the second page. You'll see how we structured it. And so what we did was we basically went through our tables that of basically allowed uses, and we allowed them the same way that single-family and multifamily dwellings are allowed. So basically, if it's a permitted use in a certain land use category for a single-family dwelling, then a transitional or supportive housing is allowed in the same exact way as a single-family, multifamily dwelling that isn't supportive housing or transitional housing. So we just made no distinction. We just wanted to clarify in our tables that that's allowed. So.
Okay, so basically we are just meeting state law here.
Right.
It's clarification, and it's, are we actually changing anything from the way we currently do it? Are we actually making an actual change or just clarifying what we're already
doing? We're just clarifying what the law is requiring us to do. We're not saying we're going to change any standards at all for single family or multifamily dwellings or anything like that. We're just basically treating them the same way as any other development project that came in. Same development standards, same permits required, everything. Because a residential care facility is really a facility. It's not rented dwelling units. And that's why we put them as residential and multifamily dwellings, because a residential care facility is a residential use, but it's really a facility. They're not dwelling units that you rent to transitional supportive housing clients. It's a different type of facility.
Okay, so that's why that distinction has been made there, that I believe Commissioner White had some questions about. So let's get into them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I talked to Morgan prior to the hearing, and she gave me that same explanation. I'm having a real struggle with this one. You weren't at the last hearing, but I said I didn't have near as much problem with the emergency shelter aspect of this as the transitional and supportive housing, because what is it read now, the way I understand it, they're categorized under residential care, and they have a limit of 6 persons before they're required for a discretionary permit. And I asked that question on this particular item, and the answer I'm getting is that this is more of rental housing, where residential care is not, and Morgan just articulated that.
But right, so I'd just like to clarify at this point, because I'm not sure I'm clear. I don't believe there's an actual change from existing treatment versus future treatment. Am I wrong on
yes,
that?
Chairman Wyatt, that's the staff position as well, that the effect of our existing regulations aren't really changing with this. This is really just clarifying how we're complying with state law. So if a rental development came into us, apartment complex of 5 units, and they were up front with us and told us we have federal or state funding, it's going to be supportive housing, we would meet with them, as we normally do in a pre-application conference, make sure it doesn't cross the line into another use definition, such as residential care, which has a 24-hour care provision. And if it was still just supportive housing and not residential care, we would treat it as an apartment complex, and we would issue a permit accordingly. So that is the staff position. It's not really a change in the meaning of our ordinances, but it does clarify that we are, in fact, in compliance with state law. And as Morgan commented in her presentation, some jurisdictions are choosing not to add these definitions just to make sure their staff are aware of the meaning of state law. And we could have gone that route, but the staff's concern was, would it be clear to applicants and staff in the future that SB2 changed that section of the government code and we can't treat these different from rental housing? And so that's why we proposed these changes in the ordinance.
Okay, so
I'm just having a real hard time getting my arms around that one. In my mind, I do see a change, because right now halfway houses, for example, are specified under residential care facilities in our existing land use ordinance. Am I correct in that? That's correct.
It depends on how it's structured. I mean, for example, and this is a clarification too. So if there is a halfway house that was a facility but not units, like not even a single family dwelling, then it would be permitted as a residential care even after this. If there was, 7 or more boarders, for example, but if they came in and it was a single family dwelling and there were services there and ran as a transitional housing facility, or transitional house, actually, not really even a facility, then we wouldn't require an additional or any different permitting than a single family dwelling. So it kind of depends on how the facility is operated or if it's housing and what type of supervision there is. So it's, you know, there's definitely some, it's going to depend on that.
What I'm hearing is it is clear as mud, Commissioner White.
Yeah.
There are a lot of definitions here, and I applaud staff for trying to sort through this and make the separate definitions, so when people come in, we can try our best to call it what it is. But you know, what I'm hearing it from your confusion and description is that's a little hard to do based on level of supervision, and there's some crossover, you know, and there are some time frames, less than 6 months, more, but maybe, maybe not. Yeah, it's not perfectly clear, but I think it's in our best interest to try to sort it out and get these definitions in here at risk of some confusion and overlap. Mr. Stevenson?
Thank you. I think for me, the way I look at this is if there's a care component, then it fits into the residential care side. And I think what staff is trying to say is if that's not a component, then it's treated the same as a house. But here you have, under our ordinance now, six or fewer residential care is allowed without discretionary permit. Over seven does require it. So that's the way I'm looking at it. I think that's what
and I understand that aspect, and that's not that doesn't cover my entire concern. And, you know, I don't see where SB2 under transitional housing on page 5 requires us to put it in a category in Table A2. It just says we need to recognize it as residential. So would we be able to convert to discretion of the planning director to apply these where, depending on a case-by-case, apply them where most appropriate?
No, the only difference would be if we didn't actually put in these definitions or show them in the use tables, we would still have to implement it the same way. It's just that it wouldn't be as clear to the public and to staff.
And I do applaud staff, because I talked to Dana earlier about this too, and he explained to me they're trying to, you know, accommodate predictability for the applicant so they don't go through a lengthy process and find out that, you know, not have a clear roadmap to where they can go here. This is a very, very difficult one for me because my concern, again, isn't as much...
We're really changing our organization and wording a bit, but that's currently allowed. So we're not changing the actual allowance.
Can staff chime in here just a little bit? The key for the residential care definition that triggers that is the 24-hour care or supervision. So if, in fact, as Commissioner White posed, there's a dwelling or an apartment complex in an existing neighborhood and it's been just rental housing, and the owner decides to, well, I'm going to use some state or federal funding and turn it into something else. There's not much we can do about it until it crosses the line into this other use definition. So if the neighbors complain to us that it's obvious to us they have 24-hour, you know, professional staff there, is that really just a dwelling anymore? Our enforcement staff would go out and find out. If, in fact, that was the case, we would then follow up to find out, is it allowable, is there a permit that's possible, or do we need to force them to stop the practice? We don't dispute that it can be a problem in neighborhoods. We have lots of code enforcement cases for a variety of issues, not just residential care.
And to tie into that, supportive housing and transitional housing typically does have on-site or off-site services, but it's not 24-hour care and supervision like a residential care facility. Could be a variety. I mean, services is a very broad term. They could just be linked to, you know, going to social services for something. It depends on what it is. But so the care part is much different for residential care. It's 24-hour supervision at all times.
I just want the point I'm trying to make is currently the way I understand it, that the land use ordinance defines halfway houses that now is going to be a transitional house.
It depends. Six
maximum conditions.
Thank you for that clarification. Actually, the reason why in your packet we crossed out halfway houses and self-help group homes from residential care is not because they may not be one. It's because it could be either. It depends on how they're structured. If it's a facility still, and there's 24-hour supervision, for example, it's a half, but say they're not sober yet and there's someone there 24 hours a day helping them to become sober and detox, that would be a residential care facility. But if it's a facility where, like a self-help group home where there's some kind of services and it's structured as rental apartment units or a big single family dwelling or something, then that could be transitional or supportive housing. So it's a little bit confusing because it looks like it will never be that, but it could be. It's just that it's not always that. So
here's what I'm looking at, Bruce. That I understand your concerns because, yeah, that's always a problem. In when anybody builds anything next to you, it's like, well, what are they going to put there? And I guess that's the way I'm looking at it, is that if you're going to look at it the way you are, where you're saying, well, can I really find out that it's not a detriment to the health and welfare safety of the neighborhood, I can say any development of a, say, a, either a big house or anything could theoretically be a detriment. If they could bring in a dog that barks 24 hours and drives me crazy. They could bring in four teenagers. They could bring in somebody who has a rock band playing in a garage every week. So if you want to get, you know, really theoretical, it's you could make that argument about pretty much any application that comes through. So my theory, the way I'm looking at this is that because we are really not changing the way that we're currently treating these types of applications in the first place, we don't have any, I mean, we don't have any factual basis to say that that this language change will cause a detriment, because it could or it couldn't, but it could or it couldn't pretty much at random, just like any house or a regular apartment building.
Yes,
so
I do understand
that. I'm comfortable with making that finding, because...
And thank you for that, because
yes.
You are making, and staff is making me more comfortable as we talk here. That's why I appreciate the indulgence here. I just wanted to try to
get... This one I know is tricky, because you kind of go, ugh.
And in the last hearing, if you recall, I did say that. Then we're really relying on code enforcement at this point. And I understand we don't want to prejudice any citizen against the right to live wherever. But my specific concern is there comes a point where it's a facility.
And it sounds to me that in that case.
And the 24-hour care triggers the facility, but I didn't know if. You know, if it's a parolee halfway house, if that's funded in a certain way, if that could also trigger it as a facility.
Again, I think it depends on how it's structured. If it's a rental unit, then it would be just transitional supportive housing. But if it's a facility run by, you know, by the government, and they're not paying rent and they're getting services, that would really be a residential care facility.
Well, if there's a way that we can clarify that word, that holds true, because, again, there's a big difference from people living self-sufficiently, and they should all be entitled to the same rights that any citizen has to live where they choose. But if they're subsidized and they're actually in a program, in my mind it becomes a facility, and that's what I'm not comfortable unleashing facilities.
Well, automatically because they're subsidized?
Well, not necessarily.
It's not going to be bulletproof here. But we've got the residential care definition, like Ms. Terrell mentioned, with the 24-hour supervision provided. So really that's what, as she's explained, is kicking in that residential care.
And if staff can offer one more nuance, if you don't mind me saying that, in the residential care definition, something that is different from supportive housing or transitional housing is, this is for categories of persons with, quote, some limits on the ability for self-care. So in the supportive housing and transitional housing, there may be services provided, but it doesn't have those precise words. Granted, it is a nuance, but it is another difference.
That these are special groups.
And then I keep falling back on director discretion, where they'll have the opportunity to evaluate these. So is there any way to put it, in other words, if we just didn't list it, so that when these types of projects come forward, it may go, well, yeah, you fit right within the lines, go forward, or where the director has the discretion to say, wait a minute, I want to maybe get a closer look at this.
Right. I don't think that would get us there. I don't think that the director would have discretion if we didn't address it. It would still be treated, if it went to a department hearing or a planning commission, a regular multifamily or single family project, it would do the same. So I think it would be actually more confusing to have no clarification on that, because then the public and staff and future staff may not understand the difference between all of these.
And that is the key, really, is the future staff, because we're all familiar, because we've been reading, rereading, and rereading SB2 in our ordinances.
And now you're confusing me, because you said before that your concern was kind of like already existing housing, kind of converting, and now you're talking about new projects.
Well,
problematic, because you're talking about it from the beginning.
You're right.
Yeah.
And my thought when I'm asking this question is, if a phone call is made from a neighbor that, hey, you know, I've got 20 people next door going in and out of this place every 6 months, can they do that? How will staff respond to that?
And I wanted to to make it clear too, for transitional housing, you do have the provider does have to allow the client to live there at least 6 months. That's a requirement of transitional housing. Supportive housing doesn't have a length of stay. It's intended to be permanent housing. I'm not saying it's possible in some cases where it might be less, but that's the intent of it. So transitional housing is intended to be 6 months to 2 years. So it shouldn't be, they shouldn't be in and out constantly every week. But
to answer Commissioner White's question, if a rental property has a rapid turnover, let's say between 6 months and 2 years, that's nothing we can do anything about. It's a relationship between the landlord and the tenant. Many rental properties do that.
Well, and again, this all goes to the original staff report that we had last Thursday with the North Coast Advisory Council's concern about there's no limitations on numerical limitations of numbers of people, and that's why I asked the questions. And for Ann's benefit, the answer I got that there is no real limitations on number of bedrooms or that for the number of people, but it's based on square footage alone.
I guess I'm still back where I was before, in that there isn't any on regular stuff any more than there is on this, and regular people moving in and out of things drive people as nuts as
that's true.
Transitional but people or supportive housing.
That's
people.
True, but when you may have a challenged population that's either a parolee or in a drug rehab or mental issues, that's my question, is when does it become a facility? And I'm hearing 24-hour care, so I guess that's the real check. That if it's a
24-hour care is one of them. Also, any kind of children's homes or orphanages, anything related to children, is a residential care facility.
Is that up to six, or is that any and all?
It would be treated the same way. Six or fewer
okay.
would not require a conditional use permit, but seven or more would.
Okay. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I was thinking one thing you might do is look at that definition of residential care. The examples that are being struck there, I think, are being struck because, as I heard Morgan explain it, it's possible that they would not fall within the definition. But if for example, you said halfway houses where 24-hour residential care is provided, then you know maybe they would fall into the category of residential care if that's the result that you wanted.
So are you suggesting a halfway house definition or putting a halfway house example into the residential care definition?
Well, the residential care definition that we currently have includes, as an example, halfway
house. Oh, halfway house,
so
right.
If you were to propose one, as Commissioner White's been discussing, currently it'd be residential care. Now, the staff said we need to strike that because under this change in the law now, it's possible that you don't have the ability to limit strictly the number of unrelated people that live in a single family home together. Or related people for that matter.
Okay. You know, in some ways, you know, if you're in a transitional care facility, you have requirements. You can't go around. I mean, if you're in a transitional thing where you're coming out of a drug rehab program or you're coming out of prison and you're in this facility, you know, halfway, you start doing things that are wrong, you get kicked out. And I always say, it's, you know, if somebody buys the house next to you, you're stuck with them. But if they're renting the house next to you, at least you can talk to their landlord. So I kind of look at this as, you know, I'm not as concerned, because I feel like if you're in a transitional facility that's 24-hour care, then you're in a residential care facility. If you're in a transitional program where there isn't anybody supervising you every day, you're just kind of going in and out, you're living your life, as long as you're behaving yourself, you're in that facility. If you're not behaving yourself, they're kicking you out anyway.
Yeah, so, like you said earlier, that can apply to anybody.
Yeah, so I'm kind of, you know, I'm just not, I really understand what you're talking about, but I'm not as concerned, because I think there's actually more constraints and people watching the kinds of facilities you're concerned about than there are watching your average neighbor.
Well, I like Tim's clarification, because then if there is ambiguity, it gives the county and the staff something to tie to that says this is a 24-hour, it's here, clear here that you're not in this category of transitional housing, you're in the residential care.
Okay, so let's go to Mr. Lilly then, or Ms. Terrell, and see if they have some wording then for that.
Yeah, staff's okay with that clarification, and we, with the chair's permission, we have a proposal for to clarify this. Under residential care, that definition, which the first one is on page 4 of Exhibit A, the second sentence here says includes. We could say includes children's homes, orphanages, and halfway houses, rehabilitation centers, and self-help group homes with 24-hour supervision.
Let's see. So is that clear then that that's referring to all of those uses or just the last one, the 24-hour supervision? Because we do already have that in the first sentence.
Yeah, it would just allow that definition to still include halfway houses and self-help group homes.
I'm not sure that helps us if we don't then put somewhere a section for halfway houses that don't have 24-hour supervision. It seems like if we're going to put that in that section with 24-hour, we need to somehow put the option of where we place those that
I think transitional housing definition, and we kind of hammered on that definition that came out of the health code, health and safety code, evidently. So the staff chose that language, but in transitional housing, and it was unclear to me until we went through it last hearing. But I think that talks about rotation through assisted units, and I think that covers the halfway houses that don't require 24-hour care.
Yeah, that's correct. The transitional and supportive housing is from the health and safety code, and residential care is not. That's an existing definition that we have, and so we're just trying to clarify, I guess, that the halfway houses and self-help group homes, for example, that have 24-hour supervision are still residential care, with the assumption that ones that do not have 24-hour supervision would be probably supportive housing or transitional housing.
Okay, well, I'm not uncomfortable with that because I think that's our intent. And so if other commissioners feel and staff feel like that more clearly conveys that intent that's agreed upon, let's try that. Will you just read that one more time, Ms. Terrell, for us?
So the second sentence of residential care land use would read, includes children's homes, orphanages, and halfway houses, rehabilitation centers, and self-help group homes with 24-hour supervision.
Anyone can do better on that wording to more clearly convey our intent?
That's good. You know, and my last question for staff, you know, I came here today anticipating not being able to support this because of this element of this ordinance change. And I was, because my comments were going to be, I think we can do better. And I think that's a step in the right direction of doing better. And my question is, can you guys think of anything else, because you're the professionals, that we could do better to comply with the law, but at the same time provide health, safety, and welfare for the public?
Nothing comes to our mind right now. If we spent some months working on this some more, we might be able to think of something, but we really don't recommend that we do that.
Okay.
Oh, there's lots on the plate, as we know from the programs you have. So Ms. Torres is still here. Let me just take a moment and ask Ms. Torres, I know this isn't your area of expertise, but does Community Action Partnership run some transitional supportive housing?
Weekly. We have weekly house meetings with the individuals and things like that. So it's a formalized plan that we put into place, but it's carried out very informally, I would say, as well, with just the limitations that we have with the case managers that are overseeing that program. But I do think that it was a very good point. It was one that I was thinking from the very beginning of this conversation, and as somebody that lives in the neighborhood as well, that there's a lot more control over people that are in these kind of supportive housing situations than just a regular tenant or neighbor that's kind of coming and going out of the place. So I haven't seen that as an issue.
Okay, thank you for that. Sure. Do you have any questions, Commissioner White, for Ms. Torres?
No,
she's up?
No, just thank you again.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so thank you, Ms. Torres. So with that, I think we've had enough discussion on this item. I hope we can convince Commissioner White to also agree on this need for this change.
Well, as I said earlier, you know, I've grateful for this second hearing because I am a lot more comfortable. I just have concerns about the inherent conflicts that still could arise. But from what I'm understanding here today, they exist today in our current ordinances. So, and I really want to support this because I just, again, I think it's a fundamental of our society that we that we accommodate, that everyone deserves the basic staples in life, you know, food, shelter, and we need to try to make that as affordable as possible. And I thank staff. I told you guys off the record earlier, and I want to say it on the public record here, that I can't think of anything that's more important to what we do here than the work that you're doing here for affordable housing. And it was greatly appreciated. So thank you.
Thank you. So ditto that. Thank you to staff for all the work on this. And to Ms. Torres, too, and Community Action Partnership for the incredible work that they do throughout the county and Santa Barbara County. Amazing work that we're hoping to see lots more of. So with that, I'm hoping then we've got a unanimous agreement then to change that language as proposed by staff for transitional housing. So I'm seeing nods, yes, 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 yes. Okay, and so that was our job for today. We have straw poll, unanimous agreement on every item then before us, all of these sections, so I'm hoping to hear a motion.
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we recommend to the Board of Supervisors the adoption of the proposed amendments to amend Title II, 2023 in the Land Use Element Local Coastal Plan Part 1 Coastal Zone Framework for Planning as amended in today's discussion. And I'm not going to reiterate those things.
I think we've had staff, as read
yes,
by staff.
As read by staff. And adoption of the negative declaration ED09-193 in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section
21,000. Okay.
I'll second.
The second? Yeah. Okay, then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Do we need a separate vote for that, or procedurally here? A roll call or something?
Call.
I think
call.
Maybe we do need a roll call. So if the clerk will please call the roll. Let's get it straight.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Malsko?
Yes.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. So with that, and thanks again to everyone. Thank you again, Ms. Torres, for coming out today. Commissioners, glad we could reach unanimous agreement then on those
good
items.
Job, Chair.
So with that, we need to continue this meeting to 29 July.
No, we need to
adjourn this meeting to 29 July. And do we need some kind of vote for that, or just mention, or
you should vote on it.
What has to happen? So, all in favor of adjourning this to then? Aye.
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 Okay. And with that, we need a motion to take.
Who made the motion?
Who did?
Who made the motion on the adjourning? You did, and the
Jen,
second.
I seconded it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and with that, we've taken all the items received into the record and as well. Thank you all.
Why didn't